I myself come to noise by way of the logic of encores. 30 years ago, I was accustomed to buying blank audio cassettes that had reassurances printed in red front and back of low noise. As an historian of technology, a poet, and a teacher of improvisational dance, I was struck by that low noise. What did it mean? I wrote out some exploratory thoughts and, in lieu of submitting a paper for publication, recorded a talk entitled Low Noise on a Low Noise Tape to be played in my absence at a seminar. The implication of low noise, it seemed to me, was not merely that the tapes would be relatively free from hiss and splutter, but that such relative freedom was good and that we had a right to expect just about perfect recording and replay. This further suggested that modern audiences must be unique, since only with the advent of phonographs and player pianos could anyone expect to hear a human performance exactly repeated. The musical and theatrical encore, a European phenomenon dating back to the late 17th century, must itself have had a vastly different import than it does now. For an audience moved by a musical passage, an aria, a ballet sequence, or a dramatic scene, would have had no assurance of witnessing it again, or so well executed. Encores, then, were far more than tenders of popularity or vehicles for praise. Despite the appearance in certain venues of claques played to applaud a play or an actress, the request for an encore would not usually have been, as today, pro forma, nor was it, as usual today, a request for the performance of another piece. An encore was the request for a reprise in the middle of the action, or what we would call an instant replay. I misspeak. An encore was no request. Compounded of immediate personal enthusiasm and of cultural despair over impending loss, shouts of encore, bis, or encore, were anxious demands. By way of repetition, one might fix in one's mind an entrancing sound, an elemental vision, a tragic moment. Wouldn't you listen? Wouldn't you hear differently as audience to singer or preacher, scientific lecturer or virtuoso pianist, if even as you arrived in hopes of spiritual exaltation, unbelievable beauty, invaluable information, astonishing invention, or sublime execution, you knew that all this would dissolve on your departure into an incomplete or irretrievable memory. Listening intently, wouldn't you too demand encores, while demanding of yourself, your children, your schools, your museums, and your secretaries, the practice of those arts of memory that afford or assist comprehensive recall? Turn and turn about, what would happen as you became accustomed to replay? Would you begin to expect live performances to be equally and exactly repeatable as were phonographic discs, piano rolls, and reels of film? During the first decades after the appearance of phonographs and player pianos, we find audiences at live performances demanding 4, 9, 12 successive encores of a favorite aria, their clap-happy applause tyrannical and disruptive, denying all operatic forward motion until they had satisfied a technologically whetted appetite for replay. Were they testing performers scientifically to make sure that the beauty of their tone or precision of their notes was not a freak instance, a singular rise to an occasion, or were they so habituated to replaying their favorite piano rolls and phonograph discs that it seemed only natural to have their favorite singers repeat a favorite aria? At last, after the tenor Enrico Caruso himself had been exhausted by a New York audience's demands for a legendary 19 encores of the same aria, one right after the other, the Metropolitan Opera Company abolished encores, period. Or would you begin to troll symphony halls and theaters for precisely those characteristics that distinguish live performance from recording? Passion which betrays itself with mistakes in notes or lines or footwork, an inspired improvisation, witty repartee between an actor and hecklers in the second balcony. Within a generation after the appearance of the phonograph and motion pictures, the infinite variations of ragtime and jazz spread across the country as countermotif to the industrial regularities of records and film. Live music concerts today insist upon, sometimes lip-synced or pre-programmed, spontaneity, a distinctive wildness that sets them apart from CDs or DVDs. In The Culture of the Copy, I explored the repercussions of our modern hunger for and our skill at reproduction and reenactment. Noise is what makes perfect repeatability humanly impossible and, in information theory, inhumanly problematic. But as I sound in between, noise also makes significance possible, and, like 19th century applause that interrupted a performance in hot pursuit of encores, the role of noise in information theory is as ambivalent as that of redundancy, which at once ensures reception and reduces significance. A book on noise is thus encore and twin, sometimes evil twin, sometimes companionable, sometimes vanishing, to a book on likenesses and facsimiles. As encore, A History of Noise must resume our infatuation with instant replay and our lust for copies more perfect than originals in order to account for our attitudes toward interruption, incompletion, and imperfection. As evil twin, noise in this book will sound inchoate, obtrusive, indelicate, obstreperous, nerve-wracking. As companion, noise will holler in the vanguard of protest, progress, advertisement, celebration, discovery. As vanishing twin, noise will be the statistical limit on the intelligibility of messages and the no longer so theoretical force between and behind fluctuating values in the futures market. I've just slipped out from the binary shackles of noise as good or bad, and away from the all-too-common belittling of noise as mere epiphenomenon, a fleeting byproduct. Evil, companionate, or vanishing, noise inhabits an historical space that is at least triune, and in any guise may be appreciated as an active historical agent, be it provocateur, saboteur, ally, or poltergeist.